If you really want to know what God's last true message is to the world, what His chosen message will be and how those who proclaim it will live and what they will preach, one of the best places you can find it is in Revelation 14. Very concise, very organized, very progressive. Revelation 14, verses 6 through 12, tells us how we are to live and what we are to tell the world. Seven mighty verses that are sort of progressive. They lead one to the next. Each one leads to the next. Each one builds on the one behind. And in those verses, you will find a complete end-time message for a world designed to get people ready to see the face of God. And you'll notice something. It all begins with Jesus. Revelation 14, 6, and I saw another angel fly in the midst of heaven, having the what? Everlasting gospel. It has the gospel, begins with the gospel, therefore it begins with Jesus. The Advent message begins with Jesus, as we'll see in just a few moments in Revelation 14, 14. It ends with Him, and everything in between is filled with Him. So Adventism begins with the gospel. I saw a mighty angel flying in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel, but notice something, it doesn't stop there, it moves on. Saying with a loud voice, fear God and give glory to Him, for the hour of His judgment is come. It moves from the gospel message to a judgment hour message. And interestingly enough, those two concepts are joined in the same sentence, separated only by a brief comma, as if the two belong together. And indeed they do. Now we're going to spend an entire evening this week on Jesus in the judgment hour message. We'll see how the most unique doctrine in the Adventist Church, one you will find nowhere else in all of Christianity, is tied through Jesus to the gospel in a way that makes it some of the best news in the Christian faith. A lot of Christians love Jesus, but they fear the judgment. You don't have to. You don't have to fear the judgment. You don't have to wonder if you're going to be saved. Because of Him, you can take it to the bank. Well, there's a gospel message and a judgment hour message, but Revelation 14 quickly moves on. In the same sentence still, and enjoins a rediscovery of creation. Worship Him that made heaven and earth, the sea and the fountains of waters. So in one powerful sentence now we have gospel, Sabbath, and now a reminder of creation, which interestingly enough, is given to a world in which people will become more and more inclined to believe we're here by accident, and a lot of very insecure people, even academic types, will feel very threatened when they're confronted with the idea of intelligent design. Our role is to remind a post-Christian, post-modern, evolutionary-minded world that we're not here by accident, there is a Creator. But you notice something, this message is not given in an abstract scientific context, it's given in a worship context. Worship Him that made heaven and earth, the sea and the fountains of waters. Now you notice something significant about the phraseology of that Revelation 14 message? It is almost verbatim taken from the language in the fourth commandment. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that in them is. I suppose if we were inclined to be critical of the Sabbath truth, we could say, well, you don't have to pay attention to that because that's plagiarized. The gospel, the judgment hour message, the Sabbath, but there's still more. I so appreciated Elder Gallimore's message last night centering on this thing. Revelation 14, verses 8 through 11 describe an end-time crisis in which a frightened world faces the economic collapse foretold in Revelation 18, the terror predicted by Jesus in Luke 21, natural disasters foretold in Matthew 24, and a frightened world reverts to a primitive herding instinct and to a globalism which is apparently held together with the glue of religion. But it's a religion not built on faith, it's a religion built on force and fear. Revelation predicts, and causeth as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed. Seven verses in Revelation 14 describe the Advent message. Four of them, over 50%, are used to describe the warning God's people have to give to a frightened and desperate world about to throw away religious liberty. Our topic tonight is Jesus is coming soon. This week we're going to put Jesus at the very center of every Adventist truth we have. Ladies and gentlemen, what we have in this faith is the most awesome collection of truths ever entrusted to a generation of human beings to share with the world. Wonderful truths. But if we don't put Jesus in the center of them, they're only words. If we don't see Jesus as the very center, the axle around which every one of these truths turn, I fear all we can possibly do by proclaiming them is to produce biblically literate, prophetically aware, probably more healthy sinners. You put Jesus into these things. You see where He centers in every one of these truths. Put Him at the center. On top of that, see the Holy Spirit descending with that mighty creative force out of creation week. And this is a series of messages that can stop human history and bring on the second coming. So we're going to put Jesus in the center of all these Adventist truths this week. By the way, I think that's why I fell off that bicycle with that strange feeling of a push that shouldn't have been there. I think that's why my wife almost died in an auto crash. I was planning this week to do something I've never done before. Go through and validate the basic Advent message, but to do so in a way that elevates Jesus. And I don't think the devil could stand it. But here we are. So tonight we're going to talk about the end of time. I'm a tax litigation attorney in Los Angeles from 21 stories above LA City Hall, which I look right out on. I see things coming. I see a storm coming. I don't like to see what I'm seeing in a way because I live well in Los Angeles. But ladies and gentlemen, I don't see a way through this one. I see a train wreck coming. We'll talk about that tonight. Geopolitical events, geoeconomic events, trends within the world we live in, which I think could lead us, if heaven ordains, and we discover the value of the truth we have to share, could lead directly and quickly to the second coming. So there's an end time warning message God's people have to give, but that's not all. Now we move to the very summit of the Advent message, Revelation 14:12. Here are they that preach the commandments. Did I get that right? No, I didn't. It doesn't say, here are they that preach the commandments. It certainly doesn't say, here are they who invent the theologically most extravagant way of showing how you can't keep them. It says, here are they that keep the commandments of God. Generation of God's people, maybe us, if we're not the fortunate one, some generation will, actually preach in the most powerful way God's end time message by simply living the commandments. The most powerful sermon you can deliver is not what you say, but how you live. At the end of time, a generation of believers will actually deliver the message God's law can be kept. There are some who say, oh, it can't be done. You can't do that. You just get comfortable with yourself and recognize that at the second coming, the Lord will miraculously lift you out of the desire to sin. Well, we'll talk about that this week. Jesus, how Jesus sets us free. Because He does. He can and He does. But for now, it's enough to say, the question is, can we keep the commandments? My response is, of course we can. How do I know? Because the Bible says so. That ought to be reasonably good authority. Then finally the question is, well, how do this generation of God's people do that? How do they keep the commandments? And Revelation 14:12 goes on to explain how. They do it the only way you ever can. They have the faith of Jesus. We'll talk this evening, this week, about the faith of Jesus. What it is, that absolute trust in the Heavenly Father that will obey no matter what. Like Job said, though He slay me, yet will I trust Him. That level of spiritual maturity. When God's people reach that level of trust in God, they no longer care whether the world agrees or disagrees with them. They no longer worry about whether they're accepted in the broader theological community. They just follow the Word, because now their horizon is infinite. Be thou faithful unto death, and I will give thee a crown of life. Now notice something. When that happens, just two verses later, something wonderful happens in Revelation 14:14. The whole eastern sky lights up. I mean, it's boiling with incandescent with energy. The entire army of the cosmos comes to this one little world. So many angels, they look like a cloud of light, the base of which boils like fire, over the top of which is a sky-filling rainbow. And in the center, who's there? The same Lord who is the center of every Adventist truth. So I'll say it again. Jesus is Lord. Well, that's the Adventist dream. It's an awesome thing to preach. But unless we put Jesus in the center, it doesn't have power. So this morning I want for just a few moments to go back and just kind of rediscover Him. And I thought maybe the way to do that would be to just go through a few hours of one day of His life. And if you'd like to follow on in the Word, you might be turning to Mark 14. Because that's kind of where we're going to center. And it's an evening in Jerusalem. And the sun has slipped below the western horizon. So it's actually Friday now, according to biblical reckoning. The evening and the morning were the first day. This is now beginning to be the sixth day of the week, Friday. And Jerusalem is just a wonderland of lights. There's torchlight and lamplight and all of the windows and doorways and merchant stalls. And even out on the slopes of the Mount of Olives, there are campfires because thousands and thousands of people have come. This is Pesach. This is the great festival celebrating Jewish freedom from slavery. And over the crest of the Mount of Olives, a large Passover moon illumines, begins to wash the valley with silver light. And somewhere in town, somewhere in the city there, there's a large home owned by a wealthy lady. And her name is Mary. None of the Marys we've become used to in reading the Gospel, she's another one. It's actually the Hebrew word is Miriam, same as Moses' sister's name. And in Hebrew, that name simply means stubborn. And a lot of Jewish girls got named Mary back then. And this Mary's home has a large upstairs room. It's kind of a loft. It can easily seat 120 people. We will discover that later on in the early Christian church when that's where they meet. And there are 13 men there gathered for a special meal on the Passover weekend. And downstairs is a young man, I think probably preteen or very, very early teen, by the name of John Mark. And he hears what's going on upstairs and he can't stand it. He sneaks up the stairs and looks through a crack in the door. And Mary comes along and she says, John Mark, you know, when Mom uses both your names, she means it. And escorts him, perhaps by his ear, back to his bedroom, says, John Mark, I've told you already, go to bed. Get in bed and don't get up again, because there's a peach tree out in the courtyard. And if you get up again, there's a limb, you know, with nice stiff branches on it. You'll be picking a switch for me to remind you to obey. So John Mark undresses and goes to bed. Now you wonder where I'm getting all this stuff, don't you? Well, just hang on a few minutes and I'll explain it. Because I think it's a pretty reasonable supposition. So during the course of the evening, there is a rise and fall of voices upstairs, and somewhere probably around 10:30, 11 p.m., there's a brief excited exchange of conversation. Then somebody slams the door and walks down the outside stairway, and his footsteps lead off to the Temple Mount. And John Mark is in bed there, undressed and wondering what is going on. Then he hears the Passover Hallel sung, and he hears 12 men, 11 men and one cosmic visitor going down the steps, and John Mark just can't stand it. But he's undressed. What's he going to do? He has to know where they're going and what they're doing, but he's undressed in bed. He doesn't dare light the oil lamp. Mary will see that coming out from under the door, and he thinks to himself, here's a sheet. I'm lying under a sheet. That will do very nicely. Wraps it around him, probably vaults out the window, and scampers along behind Jesus and the 11 disciples through the narrow streets of Jerusalem, down the Kidron Gorge, across the creek, up the other side, into a place called Gethsemane, which in Hebrew simply means place of the olive press. And Jesus is now beginning to be strangely bent, as if the weight of the world is coming down on him. Same thing happens there in Gethsemane when they pick the olives into this big round stone. They put it on top of the olive harvest, and tons of pressure force the olive oil out. And that's happening to Jesus now in a very special way, a very catastrophic way. And, you know, guys, we sometimes get caught up in our manhood. You know, we go to the gym, we try to buff up. We waste money on Corvettes. I wasted lots of money on lots of Corvettes. So I'm speaking to myself. We get hung up on our manhood. You want to see a real man.
Look at him.
Lifting the weight of the world. Bench press that.
Well, the disciples are tough Galilean fishermen.
But they can't take it. They retreat into the anesthesia of sleep because something's going terribly wrong. And along toward midnight, probably maybe 12:30, out through the same eastern gate comes this gaggle of noisy people with torches and temple police and a few probably hired renegade Roman legionnaires off duty. And they come unerringly exactly to where Jesus is praying, as if somebody in the group knows the way very well. And there is a brief fracas. You know, Peter does that famous ear ectomy with his short fisherman's sword. Jesus performs his last miracle. The disciples finally realize something really bad's going to happen here, and they flee into the dark, and somebody else flees. It's John Mark. Now, you don't believe what I'm telling you. Go back to the book of Mark and read it. And I'm not going to tell you where it is. Start with verse 1, chapter 1, and keep reading until you get there, because it's all good stuff. And what does John Mark say? And a certain young man, clad only in a sheet, they laid hold of. And here's what I love about young people, you know? They're sharp, they're clear, and everything they got still works. You get my age, everything, you know, everything hurts, and what doesn't hurt doesn't work. But John Mark is young, he's fast, he says, Buster, if you want that sheet, it's yours. And skins out of it and runs back home, and John Mark said there was a certain young man there who fled naked into the dark. You notice he doesn't give the name. Who would? And now Jesus' hands are wrenched behind his back and tied off. They're not worried about circulation. He won't be alive enough to worry about gangrene. And he is led back into the eastern gate and into a large reception room paved with stones on which servants have swept out the dust and then probably with wet sea sponges cleaned it up and laid down a semicircle of probably 69 pillows. Now, when the Sanhedrin sat as Israel's Supreme Court, there were usually 71 pillows in a perfect semicircle. I have a feeling tonight there were only 69 because I don't think Joseph and Nicodemus were invited. So there's this perfect semicircle of big pillows stuffed with wool on which the Supreme Court of Israel would sit. Right in the center of that semicircle is where the prisoner would stand, and right there is where the witnesses would stand, for the very obvious reason that every member of the court had an equally good view of the testimony and of the accused. And now the court enters, lordly-looking men in white linen, barefoot. Their shoes come off because this is holy ground. They're sitting in judgment on the life of a son of Israel. And the high priest enters. He's crowned with a turban of blue inwrought with gold, across which is written in Hebrew, Kodesh, Adonai, holiness to the Lord. On his bosom is this jeweled breastplate of judgment. By the way, the gemstones in the breastplate of judgment are the same stones exactly as found in the foundation stones of the cosmic capital. And that's resplendent against a flowing robe of blue, gathered about the waist with a purple sash, scarlet and blue embroidery, billowing linen sleeves. The high priest comes in and think about what he's wearing, the colors he's wearing. White is the righteousness of God. Blue is the law. Red is the blood of the atonement. Purple is where those two mix. And gold is a symbol of mercy. He's wearing the plan of salvation. So when he tears it, what he's doing is tearing the plan of salvation apart. Right in front of the high priest who sits in the center of that semicircle, there will be three scribes. One votes, one when the proceedings are over and the Sanhedrin votes, one records the votes for conviction. That's the one on the left of the high priest. The one on the right-hand side of the high priest records the votes for salvation, and the one in the center tallies both and as a double check. In our American courts, we only have a single court reporter. That wasn't good enough for the Jewish system. You had three. In the whole history of the world, there's nothing like the Hebrew legal system at the time of Christ. It was designed to make one thing totally impossible, and that is to convict an innocent person. Pretty tough to convict a guilty person in that system. They had a saying that a Sanhedrin who condemned the son of Israel as often as once every 10 years.
was nothing but a butcher shop.
In Israel, there was no such thing as defense counsel. Didn't exist. Why? Because the court itself defended the accused.
Beginning to sound like something, does it remind you just a little bit of the plan of salvation?
71, on this night, probably 69, of the most senior Jewish lawyers in the world. All of them spoke multiple languages because the court itself had to understand testimony in any language. They didn't use court interpreters. The court itself had to understand. All of these had been sitting judges in lower courts. Many of them had committed the Torah to memory. There were giants among them, like Gamaliel and Hillel. Gamaliel, who brilliantly defended the early Christian church and stopped the entire Sanhedrin in its tracks. Hillel, who formulated the golden rule. Jesus didn't think that up initially, originally. He's just quoting Hillel when he says it. He's speaking to Jews using Jewish truths, trying to reach them. And any member of this court who had anything against the accused was under a solemn duty to get up off that pillow, leave the courtroom, put his shoes on, and not be seen again, because this court had to defend the accused, not prosecute. Now, likewise, there was no prosecutor, no prosecuting attorney at all. The prosecution was handled by lay people, the lay witnesses who were bringing this case against the accused individual. They probably had never been to court before. The proceedings were unfamiliar to them. They would stumble through the seven ritual questions of the Hakiroth, and then they would testify. Then they would be led out of court, and the next witness would come in, and they couldn't hear each other testify. And everything all the witnesses said had to perfectly agree. There was a Jewish law called the Law of Strict Agreement. And when they were done testifying, they were cross-examined by 71 of the brightest minds in Israel. Now, I don't know, don't raise your hand, but if anybody here has ever gone to trial and been cross-examined, if you've ever been deposed, had your deposition taken by competent trial counsel, you will recognize it's true when I say that there is no antiperspirant entirely adequate to the task. It's not a fun experience. Now, you're talking usually in a deposition sitting across a mahogany table from one or two hostile attorneys. Here you got 71 of them climbing down your throat trying to save that Jewish life. How are you going to win your case? You've never even been trained in the law. And the Sanhedrin took its job so seriously that if they couldn't come up with a theory to save a Jewish life, the evidence was overwhelming, they had to condemn the person to death. They were required then to fast and pray overnight, rehear the case the next day, and at that point, sitting behind that semicircle of judges were several rows of young, aspiring lawyers wanting to get on the High Court of Israel. They were called disciples. That's where Jesus' followers got their name, just out of Jewish tradition. And if one of those young, on-the-make Jewish lawyers, would-be members of the Sanhedrin, could come up with a theory that would save the life of the accused, and the court hadn't been able to do it, that instant, that person would be elevated to life membership on the court. That was Jewish law. It also required that trials be held during the daylight hours. Now, most Christians know that. They recognize the trial of Jesus was illegal, but they don't know why. It comes right out of Jewish jurisprudence. You see, the act of trying a son of Israel was a religious act, and for that reason, it could not begin before the morning sacrifice for sin. It couldn't extend beyond the evening sacrifice. It had to happen during the day. So now in the illegal night court, Caiaphas calls the proceedings to order. The first witness is called. He's asked the seven ritual questions of the Hakiroth. Was it in a Jubilee year? Was it an ordinary year? What month? What day? What hour? What place do you identify the accused? Those questions were asked of every witness. Then he was invited to state his accusation. And so the first witness comes in. I heard this fellow say. Gives us a little spiel about tearing down the temple and rebuilding it, then he departs. Now for Caiaphas, who should have been the leader of Jesus' defense team, but who was actually his chief prosecutor, so far so good. You got one witness in, you got the testimony in. All you have to have under Jewish law, under Levitical law, is one more person who will say exactly the same thing, and bingo, you have a conviction.
be nice to get three, but he doesn't have to have three. So the second witness comes in, responds to the foundational questions. Was it a jubilee or an ordinary year? What day, what hour, what place do you recognize the prisoner? And then something goes wrong. The testimony does not strictly agree. And Caiaphas is in real trouble. And witness after witness are called in, and none of their testimony agrees. And here's the problem for Caiaphas. He's tried to bring a proceeding against Jesus here under the legal theory of sedition. Why, this man's talking about ripping down one of the wonders of the Roman world, this temple that's been 40 years plus being built with the, bless his heart, with the astonishing generosity of His Majesty the Emperor. Now, Tiberius is the emperor right now. The guy is nuts. He is a classic case of paranoid schizophrenia. And you talk about tearing the temple down, ruining a major Roman mark of excellence. And you can go to Pilate and say, Pilate, Your Honor, we have caught and convicted a terrorist. And that's something Pilate can easily condemn Jesus for. So that's where Caiaphas is trying to go. But his trial begins to fall apart because no two witnesses say exactly the same thing. Even under a mild cross-examination from those 69 Jewish lawyers, they simply fall apart, and under the rule of strict agreement, it's impossible to get a conviction. Caiaphas was instantly in trouble. Now, look at Mark 14:55. You had your finger in the 14th chapter of the book of Mark. Now the chief priests and all the council sought testimony against Jesus to put Him to death. What's wrong there? That's His defense team under Jewish law, and they're acting like a prosecutor. They sought testimony against Jesus to put Him to death, but they found how much? None. Not that there weren't people saying bad things against Jesus, simply because they couldn't get their testimony to agree. Something's wrong. The Jewish legal system is fighting back. It was designed by God Himself to resemble a plan of salvation. It's structured to make it impossible to do what the Sanhedrin's trying to do. And the testimony does not perfectly agree. As the witnesses don't hear each other speak, they're out in a separate room and they don't get it right. The system was designed to make perjury instantaneously detectable. As soon as the testimony conflicted, it was the duty of the chief justice, of the high priest, of Caiaphas, to set the prisoner free. Mistrial. Go free. Well, either from lack of time or plain carelessness, Jesus' accusers hadn't prepped their witnesses correctly, so Mark says they found none. Now look at Mark 14, verse 56. For many bore false witness against Him, but their testimonies did not agree. 57, then some rose up and bore false witness, saying, we heard Him say, objection, Your Honor, hearsay. Sustained. Even our fallible American courts would stop you right there. Pretty simple speech to memorize. In English, it's only 25 words long. But they couldn't get it together. So the trial is in crisis now. Caiaphas is about to lose the trial of the ages. I imagine his adrenaline levels now are somewhere in the danger zone, as is probably his level of stomach acid. At this point, he's badly needing a combination of Lyrica and Gaviscon. You know that's happening because look what happens next. Look at verse 60, Mark 14, verse 60. And the high priest stood up. Now think about that. In our American courts, the judge sits on an elevated platform on the bench looking down at the court. In the Hebrew system, the judges were on the floor looking up. Totally different perspective. Now, Caiaphas stands up, gets off that pillow, puts his bare feet against the cold stone floor, stands up because the adrenaline won't allow him to sit any longer, and then he says something. Stood up in the midst and asked Jesus, saying, do you answer nothing? What is it these men testify against you? And what does Jesus do? Absolutely nothing. Verse 61, he kept silent and answered nothing. He just let Caiaphas fall without propping him up. Sanhedrin had desperately hoped for a conviction on a charge of sedition, of terrorism, something they could sell Pontius Pilate. but they hadn't gotten the witnesses. Now, Caiaphas is no fool. He does a little bit of on-the-spot lawyering. He changes the theory of the trial from one of sedition, one of treason against Rome, to the theory of blasphemy, a totally different theory on which prosecution will occur. That one's going to be tough to sell to a Roman governor. Now we're ready for verse 61. Again, the high priest asked him, saying, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed?" And keep your finger in Mark 14, but just to show how wonderful it is to have four different views of Jesus' life, turn back to Matthew 26. And here's Matthew, who is a revenue agent. Now, I work with revenue agents all the time. I'm a tax defense lawyer. We work with our counterparts in government, and revenue agents tend to be very fixated on detail, on weights, measures, and numbers, and Matthew fits the profile because he's more precise here. He's more specific. Matthew 26:63, Matthew quotes the high priest as saying, "High priest answered and said unto him, I adjure thee by the living God that thou tell us whether thou be the Christ, the Son of God." Asks him in God's name, the living God. You address divinity in terms like that, you will get an answer. But you may not like it. What's the next thing you hear in that big, echoey, stone-walled courtroom? Jesus speaks out in Aramaic, "Eyah." Two mighty words. "I am." What's he said? The ancient Hebrew name of God. Why does God call himself I am? I used to wonder about that as a kid. That's not a name, it's a simple sentence. It's a declarative sentence, subject predicate, I am. And it took me years. I'm slow, but I'm not hopeless. I finally figured it out. The only being in the universe that can make that statement is God himself. None of the rest of us have life inherent within us. Only God can say, I am, I have life inherent within me. John 1 in the New English Bible says, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, the Word was God. All that came to be was alive with His life." By the way, the next time you hear somebody tell you sin isn't that big a deal, and you're going to be doing it till you see Jesus in the clouds, think about what you're doing with sin. The only life you've got is His. You borrowed it. You're taking His life and misusing it. That's kind of like crucifying Him again, isn't it? So Jesus says those mighty words, "Eyah, I am." They ring out through the courtroom. They're not lost on Caiaphas. He's no fool. He's a scholar. He gets the point. That's what God told Moses to say the name of God was. But you know, when you challenge the Lord, you have to get more than you bargained for, and that happens here. Jesus goes on to say, "And you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power." Right hand of power. Sometimes people criticize our long-understood sanctuary understanding in Adventism, our view of what happened to heavenly sanctuary, and they say, well, Paul says when Jesus went to heaven, he ascended to the right hand of God, so now we have a problem with heavenly geography because he's at the right hand of the throne. They don't get the point. What Paul is saying, and I firmly believe Paul wrote the book of Hebrews, that were probably transcribed by some other writer, hence the Greek is a little different, but I believe Paul is the author of Hebrews. Paul is a Jewish lawyer. He studied under Gamaliel. He understood the system. And when he said Jesus was ascending to the right hand of power, he understood, just as Jesus had, that that right hand scribe is the one that records the votes for salvation. That's the issue here. So Jesus basically says, "You will see me sitting at the right hand of power." And the next thing you hear in the courtroom is that sound of ripping cloth. Red and white and blue and purple and gold coming apart, and Caiaphas is tearing apart symbolically the plan of salvation. And he speaks. "What further need do we have of witnesses? Ye have heard the blasphemy." What do you think? Two things wrong there. Number one, Caiaphas should have been Jesus' defense lawyer. He's acting like a prosecutor. But more than that, he speaks. Even in our Supreme Court here in America, when the nine justices retire to that conference room back on, what is it, 2nd or 3rd Avenue Northeast, you can see the chandelier from the Northeast street that goes by it. And they start to debate a case that's been argued. The most junior member of the court speaks first. Why? Because if a chief justice says something first, a junior member might be unduly influenced. So the youngest, newest member of the court speaks first, and then they discuss the case, exactly what was supposed to happen in the Sanhedrin. Somebody way out on the arms of that semicircle should have stood first. And there was a tradition in the Sanhedrin, you did not hear anything unfavorable to the accused until somebody on the court had said something in their defense. So the high priest speaks first. But there's something worse. Under Jewish law, you could never convict a person on their confession. It just wasn't allowed. You had to have the corroboration of two or three witnesses. The uncorroborated confession of an individual was not to be used against him. Maimonides said that in his treatment of the Sanhedrin. We have it as a fundamental principle of our jurisprudence. No one can bring an accusation against himself. Confession is not to be used unless attested to by two other witnesses. And then verse 64, right there in Mark 14, says they all condemned him to be worthy of death. And once again, at that instant, it was the duty of Caiaphas to set Jesus free. You know why? Because any Sanhedrin that quickly and unanimously voted for conviction was deemed to smell too much like a mob, and at that point, under Jewish law, it was the requirement of the law that the president of the court, the chief justice, set the prisoner free. Now, in American law, we say, well, 12 jurors come back in 5 minutes and say, there's no doubt in our mind, Your Honor, he or she is guilty. We say there's a very high probability of guilt. Not in the Jewish system. That smelled too much like a mob. Rabbi Wise, in his book, The Martyrdom of Jesus, said, if all pronounce him guilty, having no defender in court, the verdict of guilty was invalid. Now we go to Matthew 27. Matthew 27, verse 1. When morning was come, all the chief priests and elders of the people took counsel against Jesus to put him to death. Now, you could read this and mistakenly assume it's just another view of the same trial, but it's not. This is a rehearing. When an individual has been condemned to death by the Sanhedrin, they were supposed to fast and pray overnight, work hard trying to come up with some legal theory by which they could reverse their conviction. So it was kind of like an instantaneous appeal held the next day. And if you don't understand Jewish procedural law, you won't get that point. But that morning trial is what passed for a rehearing. This thing was supposed to look like it was following Jewish law. The problem is they couldn't wait a day. The next day is Shabbat. That's the Sabbath day. They can't try him then. And besides that, by then, the visitors in Jerusalem will have heard about the Galilean rabbi on trial. There could be a popular revolt. This has to happen now. They adjourn for an hour or two, then they reassemble, pretending to follow the appellate requirements of Jewish law. And that's the point where Judas comes in. Judas, the bright, ambitious, young Jewish fellow, who saw real prospects, real possibilities in this Galilean rabbi. And in his mind contrives the idea, if I push him far enough into a corner, he's going to have to save his life. He's going to have to declare for the throne, and then he'll be needing a very bright young prime minister. Judas watches in horror as this thing just goes the wrong direction, and he's saying to himself, my God, it's not happening like I planned. He's going to let this occur. But then he thinks to himself, wait a second, they've got to rehear the case. They have to have the second hearing, and I'm going to be there, and I'll turn this thing around. He goes out under whatever stump he hid that small bag of coins. 30 pieces of silver, a month's pay for a common laborer. That's all they thought Jesus was worth. Brings in those small denarii, drops them on the floor, and in Matthew 27, we see Judas appearing here in verse 3. Judas, which had betrayed him, when saw he was condemned, repented, brought the 30 pieces of silver, verse 4, saying, I have sinned, he's innocent. Smoking gun right there in front of everybody. And what's the response of Jesus' defense team? They said, what is that to us? See thou to that. Now Jesus is dragged off to Pilate, ambitious young Spaniard who married into the royal family, married Claudia, granddaughter of the emperor. Tiberius himself gave his commission to him to become procurator of Judea. And Pilate tries Jesus. I had fun describing that in my book, The Lucifer Diary, the interchange between Pilate and Jesus. Pilate finds no fault in him. He's thinking to himself, I fought in the Roman legions up in Germania. There are men able to put a javelin clean through a horse. Those are a threat to the empire. This bloody Galilean is no threat to anybody. And he comes back out and he issues a Latin verdict of acquittal. Te absolvo, I find no fault in him. And at that point, once again, the trial should have been over because under Roman law, once a verdict is entered, you don't retry the case. It's what we call res judicata. We still use the Latin term, the case has been decided. It's over. But Jesus' accusers have an argument Pilate can't handle. They begin to chant, if you let him go, you're not Caesar's friend. And you can almost hear the rhythmic chanting, not Caesar's friend, not Caesar's friend. And that's something Pilate can't manage because Tiberius is on the throne. During his reign, 52 proconsuls will be executed because he believes them to be a threat to the empire, a threat to his throne. And one of them, Fucius Geminus, was executed. His mother wept at his execution, and Tiberius said, all right, execute her too. She's showing grief at the death of a rebel against the throne. That's what Pilate's thinking about. More than he could take. He's unwilling to trade the good life. Maybe life itself, certainly the possibility of time in the Mamertine prison. Unwilling to trade what he has there for this bloody Galilean, even though he believes him to be innocent. So finally he says, Centurion. Roman officer steps up and says, yes, Excellency. There's a basin of water. At once, Excellency. Soon a basin's brought in by a legionnaire, probably has water and a sea sponge in it. And Pilate washes his hands when he should have used him. See, he's a Roman governor with a Praetorian guard and the resources of an empire at his back. Not that far away are the 5th, 10th, 12th, and 15th legions. Fully capable, as they will do just 40 years later, of reducing Jerusalem to rubble. But Pilate folds up to the chance of an unarmed mob. And after saying te absolvo, which is res judicata, which is the case decided, he issues the Latin death warrant, ibis ad crucem, let him be crucified. Well, over at Calvary, the Carnifex and his 6 legionaries are waiting. The crosses are tossed down. And a calloused Roman knee comes down on the wrist and the hammers begin to ring. And then the pain begins. And when those 6-inch spikes, they're hand-forged about 1/4 inch in diameter, when those come down on the median nerve, pain like electric jolts go all the way up the arms. And the men on either side of Jesus begin to scream. But Jesus is at peace. The ordeal of Gethsemane is behind. A great decision has been made. And I like to think that in his mind, there is this unspoken shout of victory. Abba Shalom! The war is won. There will be peace. Now, on the cross, Jesus does something remarkable. He does it in body language. He doesn't say it, doesn't have to. He says, basically, you can do this to me. You can crucify me. You can nail me here. But there's one thing you can't make me do. You can't make me stop loving you.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International copyright, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.